Good morning. You are my people with plow service or strong shovels. Glad to have you here today. Our words for our calling to worship this morning are by Clinton Lee Scott, and they are from our hymnal. From the east comes a new sun, bringing a new and unspoiled day. It has already circled the earth and looked upon distant lands and faraway peoples. It has passed over mountain ranges and the waters of the seven seas. It has shone upon laborers in the fields and into the windows of homes and shops and factories. It has beheld proud cities with gleaming towers and also the hovels of the poor. It has been witness to both good and evil, the works of honest men and women and the conspiracy of knaves. It has seen marching armies, bomb-blasted villages, and the destruction that wasteth at noonday. Now, unsullied from its tireless journey, it comes to us, messenger of the morning, bringer of a new day. Our chalice lighting words come from Heather Janules. I'm going to invite Mike to light our chalice. Our prophets died for freedom of faith. We are here in their spirit. We are here to practice and sustain our living tradition, to light a chalice, claiming for justice the heat and power of fire. I am not seeing any kids or youth in our service today, which is not surprising since most of them come to the 9 a.m. service and it is a snowy day with low attendance accordingly. So knowing that my sermon went long at the first service, I'm going to skip this excellent story, but recommend it to you. Are you familiar with this book, Henry Climbs a Mountain? Anyone? So a couple, yeah. So this is a series of books written by D.B. Johnson, and it tells stories from the life of Henry David Thoreau, but Henry's a bear in these stories. And so the first book is Henry Hikes to Fitchburg. The second book is Henry Builds a Cabin. And this is the third book, Henry Climbs a Mountain. And it's about Henry's night in jail for civil disobedience. So it's an excellent way, I recommend it to you if you have children in your life, to spread Unitarian Universalist values covertly through children's stories about bears. You know, it's all very... I'm going to read you just the back page that says about Henry. Henry David Thoreau was a great thinker and writer who lived in Concord, Massachusetts more than 150 years ago. He loved to climb mountains and be outdoors and be free to climb any time he wanted. One time he spent a night locked in jail, but even then he said that he did not feel shut in. He wrote, "It was like traveling into a far country, such as I had never expected to behold, to lie there for one night." That's from Civil Disobedience. Henry went to jail for not paying his taxes. He said he wouldn't pay taxes to a government that let some people buy and sell and own other people. This was slavery, and Henry hated it. He even helped slaves run away from their owners to be free in Canada. Henry went to jail to be an example. He hoped others would also stop paying their taxes. If enough people went to jail, he thought, the leaders of the country would change the laws, and end slavery forever. Henry told this all to the people of Concord in a speech called Civil Disobedience, which became his most important writing and was read all over the world. Mahatma Gandhi used Henry's ideas to free the people of India from the British. In America, Martin Luther King Jr., who was also inspired by Henry's writings, went to jail many times to get the government to treat all people equally. Even though Henry Thoreau was in jail for only one night, his ideas about how people can change bad laws without fighting are still being used today. This is what he wrote in Walden. "One afternoon, near the end of the first summer, when I went to the village to get a shoe from the cobblers, I was seized and put into jail because I did not pay a tax to or recognize the authority of the state, which buys and sells men, women, and children like cattle at the door of its Senate House." So thus ends the epilogue to the book. Our words for prayer or meditation this morning come from Jane Ellen Maudlin, titled Prayer for Conscience. Shake me awake when I cover my ears, when I deny your call and try to justify my actions with greed called practicality, hunger called need, desire called just desserts. Flood my hearing with the music of love that pounds through my veins. May my craving cease and my sensitivity heightened, that each moment, each day, my ears and heart are open to you. Blessed be, and amen. Our reading today comes from Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. She writes, imagine you are Emma Faye Stewart, a 30-year-old single African-American mother of two who was arrested as part of a drug sweep in Hearne, Texas. All but one of the people arrested were African-American. You are innocent. After a week in jail, you have no one to care for your two small children and are eager to get home. Your court-appointed attorney urges you to plead guilty to a drug distribution charge, saying the prosecutor has offered probation. You refuse, steadfastly proclaiming innocence. Finally, after almost a month in jail, you decide to plead guilty so you can return home to your children. Unwilling to risk a trial and years of imprisonment, you are sentenced to 10 years probation and ordered to pay $1,000 in fines as well as court and probation costs. You are also now branded a drug felon. You are no longer eligible for food stamps. You may be discriminated against in employment. You cannot vote for at least 12 years, and you are about to be evicted from public housing. Once homeless, your children will be taken from you and put in foster care. A judge eventually dismisses all cases against the defendants who did not plead guilty. At trial, the judge finds that the entire sweep was based on the testimony of a single informant who lied to the prosecution. You, however, are still a drug felon, homeless, and desperate to regain custody of your children. Now place yourself in the shoes of Clifford Reynolds, another African-American victim of the Hearne drug bust. You returned home to Bryan, Texas, to attend the funeral of your 18-month-old daughter. Before the funeral services begin, the police show up and handcuff you. You beg the officers to let you take one last look at your daughter before she is buried, and the police refuse. You are told by prosecutors that you are needed to testify against one of the defendants in a recent drug bust. You deny witnessing any drug transaction. You don't know what they're talking about. Because of your refusal to cooperate, you are indicted on felony charges. After a month of being held in jail, the charges against you are dropped. You are technically free, but as a result of your arrest and period of incarceration, you lose your job, your apartment, your furniture, and your car, not to mention the chance to say goodbye to your baby girl. This is the war on drugs. The brutal stories described above are not isolated incidents, nor are the racial identities of Emma Faye Stewart and Clifford Reynolds random or accidental. In every state across our nation, African Americans, particularly in the poorest neighborhoods, are subjected to tactics and practices that would result in public outrage and scandal if committed in middle-class white neighborhoods. In the drug war, the enemy is racially defined. Thus ends the reading. Our plate this month is shared with the Concord Prison Outreach, as we share our plate every month. And the good work that we do there and the good work of this church is what our offering is gratefully received for. More about the Concord Prison Outreach can be found in your orders of service. And great thanks to our choir this morning for your words that bring this issue to life.
Together we live and dream, but the way that's wrong.
a few years ago, after Trayvon Martin's death and before Michael Brown's, before the Black Lives Matter movement really took hold, and before our denomination did white supremacy teach-ins, Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, was the new thing, and the book that took front and center for a while in racial justice discussions. I know it was something that was preached about here at the time, and some of you, but not all of you, have read it. And so I'm going to speak from a point of view of revisiting it, but give enough information for those of you who haven't read it to follow through. So because our racial justice task force has been talking about whether or not we might hold a rededication vote of our Black Lives Matter banner on its fifth anniversary next year, and because of the work we're currently doing with the prison outreach program, and because there's a lot of controversy going on in larger Unitarian Universalist circles this year about the manner of how we do racial justice work and the labels we use to define that work, I wanted to revisit this book because it changed my thinking about the racial justice system and incarceration. But it changed my thinking in an even bigger way about the white supremacy culture in which we all live as Americans, or in America. When we hear the phrase, the new Jim Crow, applied to the racial, to the prison system, I think that people like myself, white people, often start from a place of denial. At least I know that I did have a sort of initial knee-jerk reaction that said, no, that can't be analogous. Prison and Jim Crow are two very different things. When coming from a place of having grown up in and embedded with this culture, there's an immediate argument that white people can throw up against that analogy. People are criminals. They did this to themselves, people who are in prison, we can argue. Maybe the system is biased, we can allow, giving harsher sentences to black people. Maybe we can concede that this is the result of our failure to stop poverty or create better schools. But ultimately, the argument comes out, isn't this still necessary, the prison system? There is crime, and it has to be stopped. And ultimately, prison is doing the right thing. It needs reform, sure, but ultimately, it's still necessary and it's still fair. Justice is still blind. Maybe you don't want to make these arguments, and maybe you have seen through them and seen through the layers of socialization we've had on this issue and seen through to the stark core of racism in our society and in our systems that Michelle Alexander lays bare. But the book was a clarion call for me. It was telling me to wake up. In an interview, Michelle Alexander said this: those of us in the civil rights community, we've allowed a human rights nightmare to occur on our watch. While many of us have been defending affirmative action and trying to hold on to the gains of the past, millions of people have been rounded up for relatively minor crimes, branded felons, and then released into a parallel social universe in which they are denied the same rights that our parents and grandparents fought for and some died for. That's the reality. And then she ends with this passage by saying, we've got to awaken from this colorblind slumber we're in to get to the realities of race in America. We've got to be willing to embrace those who've been labeled criminals because it's been the failure to recognize the dignity, the humanity, and the basic worth of every human being that has given rise to every racial caste system that has existed in the United States or everywhere else in the world. So I think it's our task, really, not to end not just mass incarceration, but the history of racial caste in America. Do you hear our values embedded in there, our Unitarian Universalist principles? It's our first principle in Unitarian Universalism that we believe in the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And Michelle Alexander is saying that the failure of our society to live up to that principle that we hold dear has given rise to a new racial caste system, a caste system like everyone before it. That's the conclusion. That's the task before us, to dismantle that system and the systems that give rise to that system. So let me walk you through the argument that leads us to that point. First, we need to understand why and how drug laws of ours were created. And the answer is they were not created in response to a drug crisis. Reagan called for the war on drugs before the so-called crack epidemic came about. After slavery, there was a time of confusion, Michelle Alexander tells us, before people found and settled into the new legal system of Jim Crow laws. And after the Jim Crow laws were overturned by the civil rights movement, it took us some time to find a new system to take its place. But immediately, we as a society were looking. And the word that quickly emerged as the new code word was crime. It began even before the civil rights movement. Michelle Alexander writes, H.R. Haldeman, one of Nixon's key advisors, recalls that Nixon himself deliberately pursued a Southern racial strategy. He, quote, President Nixon, emphasized that you have to face the fact that the whole problem, this is H.R. Haldeman's words, is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to. Similarly, John Ehrlichman, special counsel to the president, explained the Nixon administration's campaign strategy of 1968 in this way. We'll go after the racists. In Ehrlichman's view, this subliminal appeal to the anti-black voter was always present in Nixon's statements and speeches. So, mostly Republican politicians, although some Democrats as well, in an effort to sway working class and middle class white voters to their cause, began appealing to their fear of what would happen to their class position in the wake of the civil rights movement, and began preying on the fears that already existed of black people by systematically using language of crime as coded language for African Americans. When Reagan came along, it was easy to start the war on drugs in the absence of any real drug activity and to begin a media campaign, once crack did hit the streets, that repeatedly used images of black people when talking about the war on drugs. In fact, it's as much the media's decisions as politicians that the face of drug user and drug dealer became an image of African-American men in the eyes of the American populace. So once you have a war on drugs, the police climb on board because federal dollars are tied to the war on drugs and this funds them. And so to make that easier and give them more funding and more incentive, they become allowed as police to seize any property and keep any property seized in their war as well. And then, as Michelle Alexander documents, there are a series of laws or court cases decided that make it easier and easier for the cops to stop whoever they want, whenever they want, with no recourse from the people. And who they want to stop is largely African Americans, because when they have the ability to prosecute within lower income areas with no recourse as to good legal defense, they're going to have a higher conviction rate, and they're going to get to keep that property that's been seized. So, there are a number of excuses offered up for this. One is that African Americans are committing more drug crimes. That's false. Those statistics can be shown over and over and over again. White people do drugs in exactly the same percentages across the board. Another excuse is that African Americans are more available on the street to stop. But that doesn't matter. In car stops, they'll stop African Americans over and over again more often as well. And it's important in all of this that it's not just black people who are stopped, black people who are arrested and incarcerated. Our whole system depends on the fact that we don't do this just to black people, because that would be too clearly racist. So the system depends on the fact that it sweeps up a certain percentage of white people as well. That way we can go back to our myth number one, that A, it's really black people committing these crimes, and the system of justice is blind. But we all know that if white people in middle-class neighborhoods were being locked up at the same rate, where large percentages of our populations here in the suburbs were in jail for these drug crimes, then we would think there was something dramatically wrong with this system. But with the war on drugs, we make it legal to stop people for minor violations with the real intention of looking for drugs. We make it legal to take possession of their cars and keep them if they're found guilty, or if anyone is found using those possessions, whether or not it's the owner, is found guilty. We make it also impossible to sue for racial discrimination. The Supreme Court decided this one, basically saying only the federal government has the ability to bring this sort of case, and they never do. It seems impossible, yet it's true. Unless an officer says, yes, I pulled him over solely because he's black. Or unless a prosecutor offers up, yes, I only prosecute the ones that are black. Without that sort of direct statement, there's no longer really a case for racial discrimination that can be made in America. An officer saying that he had other reasons in addition to race is all that it takes. Deal done. Once arrested, the vast majority of cases never go to court. If you can't afford a lawyer on your own, or even if you can, despite the example in our reading, you're usually better off taking the plea bargain. Without a lawyer of your own, you're going to sit in jail, and without bail money, you're going to sit in jail until your case goes to court. So taking the plea bargain gets you out faster. You might not even have a court-appointed lawyer, believe it or not, if under your state's legal system they believe that you ought to be able to afford a lawyer because of your limited income. So when their prosecutor comes and offers you a deal, plead guilty, you'll get 10 years probation and a felony conviction on your record, but if you go to court and you're found guilty, the minimum sentence is 10 years or even 30 years jail time, most people will take the plea bargain. And whether or not a plea bargain is offered is solely at the prosecutor's discretion, as is the decision whether or not to try the case at all. The people who the prosecutor is more likely to see as just good boys who got mixed up in something but aren't really bad kids, those are the college kids. Those are the white kids. Those are the farm kids. They are not the African-American kids from the city. Those are what we think of when we say the word thugs. So your skin color ultimately makes the difference between whether or not you're pulled over, and then whether or not you're tried, and then whether or not you're offered a plea bargain. And I have to say, if I was given the choice, if I was swept up in a drug raid and I couldn't afford a top-notch lawyer, and there was a chance I would be found guilty because drugs were present on someone else there, I would plead guilty. I read the story of Elaine Bartlett in the book Life on the Outside. Elaine tried to claim that she was innocent when she was arrested for a first-time case of selling cocaine. She spent 16 years in jail while her children grew up on the outside. What Elaine had done was agree to be a one-time drug runner, carrying some drugs to people outside the city in exchange for some cash. She was neither the seller nor the buyer, just the runner. But she paid a lot of time for her decision not to plea bargain, but to try to plead her innocence to the crime of selling drugs. Plenty of hard stories exist, stories of people who know that they're innocent, but were in the wrong place in the wrong time. A lot of women who end up in prison, for example, were present with a man who was caught dealing or selling or possessing drugs. And the women with that man are presumed to have knowledge of his activity and presumed to be involved in his activity. And when faced with the choice, try your case and get that extensive minimum sentence or take the plea bargain and go home with parole, they do what I would do, what you would do, or any of us would do when we fully understood those choices. Not everyone's innocent, of course. Only a small percentage, perhaps. But that small percentage amounts to a large number. And in a system when people are so discouraged from seeking a trial at all, where people are discouraged from seeking a trial, do we really have any longer the system of justice that we, as Americans, believe in? Can we say, really, that we have a system of justice that tries people fairly, equally, where people are guaranteed a fair jury by their peers, where justice is blind? If you think so, Michelle Alexander has further information for you about jury selection, but I'm going to skip that. One passage about this guilt or innocence question from Michelle Alexander I found particularly striking. She says, "The temptation is to insist that black men choose to be criminals. The system does not make them criminals, or at least not in the way that slavery made slaves or Jim Crow made them second-class citizens. The myth of choice here is seductive, but it should be resisted. African Americans are not more significantly likely to sell or use prohibited drugs than whites, but they are made criminals at drastically higher rates for precisely the same conduct. In fact, studies show that white professionals may be the most likely of any group to have engaged in illegal drug activity in their lifetime, yet they are the least likely to be made criminals." So I want to stop here for a minute, because I think we're beginning to see the bigger picture that the new Jim Crow is pointing us to. I went, as you might recall, to the University of Michigan for college. During the time I was there, I heard stories from the vast majority of my friends about doing drugs and about their friends doing drugs. The vast majority of people I knew did some kind of drugs. Drugs were ubiquitous on the college campus, a regular part of life there, as is the case on many college campuses across America. The few people who, like myself, did not partake seemed to be the exceptions to the norm. And during this time, not one friend of mine or friend of friend of mine got stopped by the police and checked for drugs, much less arrested or prosecuted. And this was after the start of the war of drugs. This was in its heyday. So there were plenty of arrests being made, but not on my college campus. Those arrests were not being made of nice young college students. I went from there to the University of Georgia for my master's degree, where I sat with the Unitarian Universalist young adult group at a picnic one day and watched them pass a joint around the circle with nearly everyone, I think absolutely everyone except for myself, partaking. None of them got arrested. I went to seminary at the University, at Meadville-Lumbert Theological School in Chicago's Hyde Park, where I heard other seminarians from various schools talk about doing drugs casually. I have seen and heard about drugs all around me, and in Unitarian Universalist circles particularly. I've been offered a joint or marijuana in some form at least 5 times by congregation members in the various congregations I've served, all of which, I assure you, I refused. All of which, I'm the rare anomalous person. And none of them were ever arrested. Does this feel familiar to you? As we look around, do you assume probably half the people here may have tried pot at least once in their lifetime? And almost none of you were arrested. How many African American adults can say that in this country? Only the ones that live in predominantly white communities, I would guess. And maybe not even them. And despite the number of states that in the last decade have been legalizing marijuana, like this one, there are still people incarcerated in those states for possession. And the ACLU says marijuana arrests now account for over half the drug arrests in the United States. Of 8.2 million marijuana arrests between 2001 and 2010, 88% were for simply having marijuana. Nationwide, the arrest data revealed one consistent trend: significant racial bias. Despite roughly equal usage rates, blacks are 3.73 times more likely than whites to be arrested for marijuana. Is Massachusetts different? Not really. If you look at the rates of arrests since we decriminalized possessing a certain amount of pot, the arrest rates here are still double for African Americans what their percentage of the population is. So, at the same time, too, while we've legalized one drug, other drugs are still illegal. And different communities have different drugs of choice. So we've legalized the favorite drug use of Unitarian Universalists, I think. But another group of people continue to be incarcerated for drug use. The problem here is that we haven't, when we address drug laws, when we address even minimum sentencing guidelines, when we even address the prison industrial system itself, we haven't addressed the underlying issue here, which is the white supremacy culture. We have to remember that the drug laws and increase in the prison system wasn't created because we have a drug problem. It was created because we have a racism problem. It was created because we had a racist system that was overturned and we needed a new racist system. And if we don't do anything about that, if we overturn this racist system, it will be replaced by another racist system. And so on and so on. And we can change the laws about this particular one, but until we change our underlying culture, we will find another way to create a new Jim Crow. Michelle Alexander spends a lot of time in the book talking about the problems that felons face after release, and I don't want to ignore those, starting with the fees and the fines they have to pay back, the inability to get a job with a felony record, and the fact that felons are barred from many services in many states, such as public housing, food stamps, and the right to vote. It adds up to a very difficult picture and makes it almost impossible for a convicted felon to successfully re-enter society. Inability to find housing can result in one's children being removed again. Inability to find work can mean lack of money for the bus or to get to parole meetings. Inability to pay fines and fees can land one back in the prison system. So, this is the system that we have, the new Jim Crow. The central concept, the undeniable fact here, is that white people can make the same choices that black people can, but people like myself are not being locked up for it. Or people like myself who do drugs are not being locked up for it. Or at least not as much, or not overwhelmingly. Again, the system relies on the fact that a certain percentage of white people are arrested and locked up, because then we can, again, plausibly deny that there's anything racist about this. Because look, it does happen to white people too. So what do we do? Michelle Alexander is suspicious of the usual suggestions: uphold affirmative action, focus on education issues and poverty issues. And it makes sense that she thinks those are not the answers. These are the reasons we're incarcerating so many African-American people. After all, upper-class people have money, power, and education, and are still doing drugs. So we're not locking people up because of drugs. We're locking them up because of race and because of class, because of money, if the statistics are right. Poverty is not really the root of incarceration either, though. It really is racism. Neither can we simply reform our prison system or our drug laws. Mild reforms won't address an issue of this magnitude, although they do need to happen to end this mass incarceration. But as long as it's still going on, we need to dismantle the system in other ways, large ways. We need to continue to address the underlying racism of this culture that supports this system. It is going to take a massive new civil rights movement from the ground up, Michelle Alexander told us. And the good news is that since she wrote this, she was right, and we had the Black Lives Matter movement arise up. And that movement has the potential to make a fundamental shift in public consciousness. So here we are in Stowe. We're about 8 miles away from the Concord Prison, and we do outreach there, which is a big step and a good step, because incarcerated people deserve compassion and deserve support. But we also need to dismantle the system that puts them there. We need to do that through partnering with UU Mass Action, which has ending mass incarceration as one of its action platforms. And then we have to do something more. We have to continually work to do what we've been doing of proclaiming that Black Lives Matter and dismantling the white supremacy culture that is the very air we breathe, working to dismantle the systems of oppression that grow up for it while addressing, at the same time, the larger culture. That's a tall order. It's a tall order, but the good news is that we are not alone in this work. There are partners and allies for us to work with, and the tide is gradually turning. Martin Luther King said, quoting Theodore Parker so long ago, "The arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice." Michelle Alexander said, "If Martin Luther King Jr. is right that the arc of history is long, but it begins towards justice, a new movement will arise. And if civil rights organizations fail to keep up with the times, they will be pushed to the side as another generation of advocates comes to the fore." She says, "This new generation of activists should not disparage their elders or their commitments or achievements. To the contrary, they should bow their heads in respect, for their forerunners have expended untold hours and made great sacrifices in an elusive quest for justice. But once respects have been paid, we should march right past them, emboldened, as King once said, by the fierce urgency of now." And so that's where I leave you. The arc of the universe does bend towards justice, but we have to keep marching forward with the fierce urgency of now to dismantle the systems that are being built before our very eyes. May it be so. To paraphrase Theodore Parker and Martin Luther King, and actually Barack Obama as well, the arc of the universe is long, and our eyes can see down it only a little ways, but we know it bends towards justice. And for it to do so, we must put our hands on that arc and do the work of bending. May it be done. May we go in peace and love and justice. Amen.